We're going to look again today at Gaza and the genocide that is taking place there. We're going to learn that it is a genocide that could be stopped by a single phone call. This is an interview show that's done by Owen Jones, and he is based in London. Here he is interviewing Gideon Levy, who is based in Tel Aviv. Gideon Levy is a journalist, a longtime columnist for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. So it's a very interesting inside commentary about Israel. This is a YouTube podcast, so if you want to see it, you can do a search for Owen Jones and Gideon Levy on YouTube.
In my view, courageous journalists in Israel. He's been speaking truth throughout this horror, and that's not easy to do in the climate which exists in Israel at the moment. Moral clarity. The last time I interviewed Gideon Levy was a few months ago, and that the term I used was moral clarity. And it's rare that I've come across someone, I think, who just personifies that. So it's really a great honour getting to be joined to talk to you in these unrelentingly bleak and horrific times. So hello.
Thank you for having me again, Owen. Always a pleasure, really.
Yeah, well, I can't say enough how much of a pleasure it is. I want to start by talking about the World Central Kitchen massacre. Now, let's be clear, 200 aid workers have already been killed, overwhelmingly Palestinians, and they haven't had attention. I'm not trying to detract from the horror that the families of those seven aid workers are feeling, but that's why this suddenly has caused a crisis of some description. Before I talk about that, though, I just want to talk about the investigation which the Israeli authorities have now conducted. And I just want your thoughts, because this was an aid at World Central Kitchen coordinating with the IDF in a supposedly deconflicted zone. They gave their coordinates on a pre-approved route in trucks, clearly marked with World Central Kitchen. And then the first car was attacked. And then as they fled to the second car, that was an attack. And then they fled to the last car, that was attacked. Then they were all killed. What I just wondered your thoughts on the investigation that have been produced and what that tells us about how the IDF operate.
Whatever happened here is exactly the opposite of what the IDF does usually. Usually there is no investigation whatsoever. And usually if there is an investigation, it lasts forever. And I'm speaking about decades of military investigations of crimes of the occupation. This time, because this dramatic phone call between Biden and Netanyahu, they rushed up and they even found some guilty commanders, one of them, by the way, a settler. Surprise, surprise. But by the end of the day, we should remember the world and Israel, unfortunately, is treating the blood of those seven adorable volunteers of the Central World Kitchen, God forbid, as much more expensive, dear, than the blood of so many Palestinians who were killed in such a similar way. Let's just make the analysis, the analogy with the 2 weeks of attack on El Shifa Hospital, the only real hospital in Gaza, or the only hospital that can be called a medical center. For 2 weeks, Israel had bombed there and killed hundreds of people and destroyed the whole compound because there were there some members of Hamas. We don't know who, we don't know how many, we will never know. I doubt if the army knows, but they were. This justified this whole killing and destruction of a hospital. Same way of thinking happened a few days later in Deir el-Balah. They saw there is one Hamas member, nobody knows who he was, how important he was. In any case, he wasn't in the car. But that's enough for them to justify to kill anyone who is around him. And that's a way of thinking. This is not an incident, not a mistake. That's a strategy. That's a way of thinking. That's a way of perceiving lives of Palestinians.
I mean, I'm wondering just in terms of what happened here, where they basically have blamed the local unit And there aren't criminal sanctions, though, are there at the moment? I mean, kind of looking pretty light action given the gravity of the crime, which was on a purported one gunman. There wasn't a gunman, and therefore an entire aid convoy is attacked with 7 aid workers killed. The reason I'm just interested, and I just want to put this to you, and I don't want to go, you know, down too much of a rabbit hole here, but Giora Island, for those who don't know who are listening, he's a Israeli major general, the former head of the Israeli National Security Council, an advisor in some capacity to Gallant, the defense minister. He said on the 7th of October, in support of the siege, and he said, in order to make the siege effective, we have to prevent others from giving assistance to Gaza. The people should be told they have two choices, to stay and to starve or to leave. Now, Gaza suffered the worst fall in nutritional status of any population in recorded history. There is a famine growing. I don't know. I mean, is it possible that this unit deliberately targeted these aid workers in order to undermine, to prevent others from providing aid?
I'm not sure. If yes, this is not the policy of the army. Then it was really an initiative of a high-rank local commander, might be. We know the background at least of one of the commanders, a very radical settler. But by the end of the day, I think that we should look at it differently. We should look at it as if the army doesn't care who are they killing, whom are they shooting. They couldn't care less if those are journalists, medical teams, aid workers, women, children, anyone. The whole Gaza Strip is in danger. The whole Gaza Strip is suspected by Israel or by the Israeli army. And in many ways, the whole Gaza Strip deserves to be killed. And you heard those expressions by so many Israelis that nobody is innocent in Gaza. And if nobody is innocent in Gaza, it includes also the 7 international aid workers. And that's the outcome. If you talk like this, if you think like this, the only difference was the national identity of 5 out of those 7 workers. They were internationals. If there would have been more internationals in Gaza, we would have seen less killing, I believe.
And they, of course, blocked foreign journalists from entering, partly because those crimes, I suppose, would be more easily documented, but also, yeah, you would end up with these sorts of incidents, wouldn't you? I mean, just in terms of what's happened since, the conversation between Joe Biden, this has triggered a crisis. Well, all of a sudden, it does. The world is being told very loudly, as Palestinians said from the beginning, Palestinian life is very cheap. This has triggered a crisis. Now, one of the outcomes is 2 crossings have been opened into Gaza, which Israel could have opened all the way through to allow aid in. I mean, doesn't that show the US used a little bit of leverage that it did actually have all along, and it could have used that all along, and that Israel has been deliberately keeping ways into Gaza which could allow food to prevent famine?
Much more than this, Owen. It showed not only that the United States has a leverage over Israel, which we knew, it showed that the leverage is much bigger than we think. And the United States is not using it. Look what happened. There are 2 things to be said here. The first one is that this phone call changed the regularities on the ground of entering aid within hours, only because of a phone call with the American president. And that proves exactly what I thought for a long time, that if the Americans would have really wanted to put an end to this war, they could have used 1 phone call to put an end to this war. The fact that President Biden, with all the appreciation to his good intentions, and I believe he has some good intentions, with all the appreciation to this, by the end of the day, he didn't put an end to this war. In other words, he wants this war to continue. In other words, the United States is a full partner of this. And the second thing is this really hypocrite way of thinking. Aid. We will support Gaza with some food, some medicines, and our conscience will be totally clean, or the American conscience, or the White House's conscience will be clean. Here, instead of 200 trucks, there will be 500 trucks a day, and Gaza is safe and secure and happy. So I must remind all of us, in Gaza, there are over 2 million people without any protection, exposed to be killed in any given moment without any protection. They are, most of them, replaced from the places, from the homes, most of them homeless. There are 17,000 children without any company of adults. They lost everything. There is not only starvation, there is fear, there is despair, there is nowhere to go. So this way of thinking that if we only double the number of the trucks, which would bring rice, if they were animals, and with this rice, our conscience will be clean and they will be happy, that's a very, very twisted way of thinking. Gaza needs ending the war today. Nothing but this. Any day that this war continues means more horrible catastrophes for the people of Gaza. And thank you, President Biden, for the trucks, for the aid. But that's not a way to really be humanitarian, to really care about the people of Gaza, to really care about the international law, and to really care about the safety of hundreds of thousands of women, children, adults, totally innocent people who deserve, after half a year, an end to their suffering. Joe Biden could bring it to them in one phone call, and he didn't.
I mean, on that, just sticking with food, that the basic point about food is, you know, what's often missing in the conversation is the fact that local agriculture, food production in Gaza has been so systematically trashed, destroyed. So it's, you know, when people talk about even comparisons with aid coming in before, well, there was food production as well, which is now gone. But also, if you've got a war going on, the infrastructure, the roads have been destroyed. It's interesting, even Biden's administration has reprimanded Netanyahu's government for blowing up, for targeting police within Gaza as though they're legitimate targets on the basis that they often provide the security for the trucks. So, I mean, that's the problem, isn't it? You get, so you've got the destruction of infrastructure and local food production. You've got a collapse in security because you've got a lot of desperate, starving people. So actually just getting trucks in doesn't solve that problem, does it?
Absolutely. And you didn't mention also some kind of industry which was in Gaza, which is also totally destroyed. Gaza produced some of its food by itself, not only in agriculture, but also in certain factories, dairies, and others. All this is gone. So, but again, food is not the whole story. I mean, food is essential, and we have to provide it. I'm very happy that there will be less starvation, even though I'm not sure that this is enough. But there are some other human needs. What about them?
I mean, you mentioned healthcare. You mentioned Al-Shifa. I mean, Gaza doesn't really have a functioning healthcare system. And I mean, if you just start to think, people with cancer, people with heart problems, pregnant women. I mean, that imposes a daily death sentence on a significant number of people, doesn't it, if you don't have a health system?
Yes, but they have sacks of rice from the United States. This should shut their mouths.
If I was going to go devil's advocate, I mean, wouldn't, you know, the argument would be, well, yeah, the US has this leverage, but actually if they told Netanyahu to end the war, then Netanyahu's government would fall and Netanyahu fears going to prison. So is that stops the leverage? What do you say to that?
Look, Netanyahu is doing whatever he wants as long as the Americans are supporting it. The moment that the United States will stop supporting what he does, in any case, Israel will have to stop. I mean, it's so basic. Israel cannot continue this war without the support of the United States, maybe for a few days, not much more. For sure not to face the next dangers from the north, from the east, from Iran. So, you know, those are not considerations. We are dealing here now with lives of maybe tens or hundreds of thousands of people for the period to come. And this is at stake now. And therefore, if Netanyahu, it doesn't depend so much on Netanyahu. if the Americans want to put an end to this war will end within hours or days. And therefore, the responsibility of Biden is so big, and therefore the betrayal is so big.
I'm just wondering in terms of what happens next, though, in the sense, Rafah, where a majority of Gaza's, as you say, desperate, homeless, hungry population, traumatized population, are now concentrated on the border with Egypt. And the Israeli government basically stakes everything on saying there will be an offensive against Rafah, which the US has done lots of hand-wringing about, but carried on providing lots of weapons to Israel in order to prosecute such an offensive. Do you think such an offensive will happen? Because obviously, you know, I interviewed, for example, a UNICEF spokesperson live from Rafah a few days ago and spelled out in gruesome terms what an offensive against Rafah would mean, particularly given they have nowhere to go. So what do you think, where do things stand with this offensive against, this onslaught against Rafah?
Again, it depends on the Americans. How decisive will they be? Until now, or until the last days, maybe they changed it in the last days, but until last days, they did say a very clear no. They just put conditions. They wanted to see plans, which cannot exist, how to save those innocent people from being killed by masses. It depends only on the United States. If the United States will want to save the life of 1.2 displaced people who are staying now in Rafah, they can do it and they should do it. Israel, as you see, are talking a lot and doing a little about Rafah because they understand the challenge, both the international one and also the challenge on the ground. To fight in a place where there are 1 million refugees is not an easy job, not at all. So I still carry the hope that maybe it will end up only in talkings and not in actions. But again, I don't see a very decisive American position.
Partly because it's in limbo, I suppose, because of the elections, which are not that far away. I mean, one thing I'm interested in is just, I mean, the question of the hostages. I mean, you know, Hamas committed grave war crimes by taking civilians hostages. No one should be any doubt about that. What I'm interested in, and just in terms of where this is in the conversation in Israel, because I know there've been protests, obviously, including by family relatives of some of the hostages. But obviously, common basic sense shows, because you'll hear people aggressively supporting the war in Gaza on the basis of the hostages, even though we've only seen mass release of hostages based on a ceasefire and a prisoner exchange. The Israeli state has killed far more hostages through military action than it's saved. Is that not just generally just, I don't understand how within Israeli society there couldn't be a basic, that could be a common sense, given that's just empirically what's happened, but it doesn't seem to be even registering.
No, there's no one in Israel who doesn't want to see the hostages being released. But there is quite a big part of Israelis who are not ready to pay anything for it. And the polls show that the majority of Israelis prefer crushing Hamas over releasing the hostages. And those are two alternative goals. They cannot go together. It's either or. I keep on saying it from the first day. You have to have your priority. Either this is your priority or this is. And the Israelis are quite clear about it. So the interesting thing is that it turned into a political issue. The left, so-called, is for releasing the hostages in any price before anything else. And the right-wingers are in favor of continuing the war in any price without ignoring the fate of the hostages, claiming that continuing the war, as Daniel says so, will bring also to the release of the hostages, which is a totally twisted logic. Because the more the war goes on, the more the life of the hostages is in danger for many reasons. So Israel really changed in a quite deep way in this war, and you can see it in the attitude toward the hostages. When we had Gilad Shalit, one individual, one soldier, the sentiment in Israel was overwhelming. People were praying and wishing for seeing him released in any price. there was very, very little resistance to the high price that Israel paid, over 1,200 prisoners, including Yehiel Sinwar, by the way, who was released for getting Gilad Shalit. Israel became less with humanity and with empathy and with mercy toward the weak ones, toward the those who suffer in this war. And it's first of all, obviously, aimed at the Palestinians. But now we see it is also aimed at the hostages. Israel cares today less about the hostages than a few months ago. And that's horrible.
You've done lots of work, I mean, just in terms of link to this, on the plight of Palestinians who have been detained by the Israeli state, who you've actually you've described as Israel's own hostages. And we've heard just reports in the last few days of then of the sort of conditions, you know, being tied up for months to the extent that people have been had their limbs amputated. Ben-Gvir doing a typically the extremist security minister, another blood curdling kind of public statement saying conditions will be made even worse. It doesn't matter how many bullets we need. As I'm just wondering about what your thoughts on the general plight there, of because we've had some horrific reports, of course, of the mistreatment of, well, the horrific treatment of Palestinian detainees.
One of the reports, which was published yesterday, the day before yesterday in Haaretz, was by a doctor who works there. So it's not just, rumors or Palestinian sources. An Israeli physician who wrote a letter. This is, again, something that tells more about Israel than about anything else. The fact that Israel is so indifferent to what every Israeli could have heard yesterday and weeks before. The fact that they don't even care about the consequences of those reports on the fate of our hostages in Hamas. What do you think will a guard of a Hamas who has two hostages under his guard, what will he do when he hears that his colleagues, his friends, are being kept in both unbelievable and inhuman conditions? What will he think and how will he behave when he hears this? And what came out of us? Such reports 10 years ago would become the talk of the day. Here, Israel is yawning and doing nothing about it. Those are really, Guantanamo starts to seem as a resort place relative to what we are hearing now about Zde Teiman, one of those military camps where they are detained. I don't know. I see those scenes in front of my eyes of people who are handicapped and covered in their eyes and being fed with a straw for half a year now. And part of the 27 died, at least 27 died out of those conditions. Many of them, and the doctors say that's a routine, lost their legs because of the woundings from the chains. What came out of Israel? What is it? And Israel was always had its problems, but it never got this low point, never.
I mean, I suppose, again, from a foreign perspective, it's something I've asked you about before, but I mean, months have gone on that, you know, Western public opinion has shifted very decisively against the Israeli state and what's happened in Gaza. There's no question about that. And partly, obviously, it's just seeing the hideous suffering of the Palestinian people in Gaza, not just Gaza, but particularly in Gaza. And it becomes hard because I speak to people like yourself. I speak to you. I speak to courageous Israeli peace activists. You talk about the humanity of the Palestinian people. But that is not, it's just the general broad consensus within Israeli society is quite shocking to a lot of people when they actually see the way the conversation on television, the kind of almost kind of like caricatured way of speaking in the most dehumanizing way about Palestinians, talking about, how, 4-year-old children aren't innocent because they'll grow up to be terrorists. You just listen to this. It's kind of like caricatured. I'm just wondering about that, just what the kind of general atmosphere is and if there's any hope in that sense.
No, Owen, I don't see any hope. I mean, when I cannot watch Israeli TV anymore, not the news programs, really cannot. I mean, almost physically, I cannot do it. It is, first of all, what you don't see. You don't see anything of the suffering of Gaza, nothing. And then from what you see, only our sacrifice, only us and us and us. We are the victims. We are the only victims. Another soldier was killed. What will be with the hostages? All very legitimate sentiments. But you cannot remain so blind and so apathetic to the suffer that you cause, which doesn't help anything to yourself. The fact that we are treating their prisoners like this doesn't help in any way for the hostages. Nothing. It just really destroys, first of all, the victims, and secondly, also their guards, Israelis. What will come out from all those phenomena? What will come out of this indifference? One day, Israelis will be asked, where have you been? You knew all this. What did you do about it? And they will say, we went to the streets and demonstrated against Netanyahu, as if replacing Netanyahu will make an entire difference, and after Netanyahu, Israel will turn into a liberal paradise.
But that does seem to be some hope, though, in what you said, in that the suggestion there is, I mean, this is what I cling on to, so I'll just be interested if you expand on it, which is people in future generations will look back and go, what on earth happened there? They'll look back at the blood-curdling statements of Israeli leaders, officials, they'll see coverage from this time on Israeli television, and the sorts of statements that circulated on social media, Telegram. I've seen some of the Telegram stuff about some of the aid workers, people just mocking the deaths of these aid workers and ridiculing these aid workers. And you kind of think, but your suggestion is actually people in the future will go, what happened there? This was an outrage. We have to come to terms with it. So that does suggest that there is hope that things can shift.
I wish I knew, where do you see hope here? It's maybe your younger age than me. Where do you see hope here? Hope for what? This will shape a whole generation now with hatred, with real criminal thinking, with racism, with believing that all the Palestinians are garbage, that you can just smash and go on and nothing happens. What hope do you see here? I really wonder.
Well, yeah, I'm struggling. I'm not going to lie. Just a couple of things. One thing I did want to put to you, actually, I don't know if you saw this article in Plus 972 magazine by Yuval Abraham. I was just thinking of a courageous journalist, Yuval Abraham. To be honest, it read like a sci-fi horror film of the use of artificial intelligence, this Lavender system, which chooses low-level so-called Hamas operatives. I mean, it's basically they're judged to be that by artificial intelligence and then, you know, waits till they're at home, bombs them and blows them up with up to 20 civilians acceptable for collateral damage. And in previous, you know, whatever we think about previous Israeli onslaughts, you wouldn't, low-level operatives, not a single.
This woman is an anomaly. Harper's Bazaar magazine featured her on the cover and said she's the author of the world's number one
civilian for collateral damage would have been acceptable. But you can see from that how we ended up with the mass destruction of Gaza, because you had the proliferation of all these targets and then they were acceptable to blow up and all the rest of it. And I guess this just reflects, it seems to me that you would never, there was the only human oversight per target is 20 seconds. And there was their verification was, are they a man? And they accept there's at least a 10% margin of error in any case. I just look at it, I just think this, I mean, it looks like I'm reading a horror film, a sci-fi horror film of the sort I grew up with. I just wonder, where does that take us? Because I look at that and think, you know, is that the future for, is this a template? Is this a template for something not just in Israel, but beyond?
Absolutely. I mean, it left me speechless, this report by Abraham. I'm not a great expert for AI. But I, by the way, the army didn't even really deny it.
No.
They had some things to say, but not a overall denial. Someone in Haaretz wrote last Friday that the destruction is already bigger than Nagasaki. When you hear those figures, when you hear about those methods, is it really so far from throwing a mass killing weapon over Gaza? We are almost there. It started with the drones, by the way, much before AI, when 90-year-old female soldiers sit in a room with screens in front of them and with their joystick killing human beings. It starts there. You know, in the battlefield, at least you see who is in front of you. It started with the pilots who never see their victims. They see black dots running on their lives. They have no idea whom they are killing. No idea. And they do. So technology will bring us really to hell.
I mean, I guess where do we end, really? We've spoken before about how I think the hope you would look at is in the US, which is obviously pulls in at the end of the day, it has leverage of a huge amount that if it can actually stop this with one phone call. I mean, just firstly on that, I mean, I'll ask a two-part question. This could end, as far as you're concerned, if Biden picks up his phone, said, "This ends now. I will end all weapon sales unless you immediately end this." That would be it.
One word, which Biden knows to pronounce very well. Don't. It's enough. But it must be followed by measures. If it's only this word or any word, it is totally meaningless. It must be followed by measures. And to say don't, and in the very same day, to supply Israel with more ammunition and more jets is really cynical.
I mean, I was struck by reading, it was a passage from, it was about 1982 during the invasion of Lebanon. And one of Ronald Reagan's advisors marched into the Oval Office in the White House going, this is too much, the atrocities, the children being murdered and slaughtered, and impressed that on Reagan. And Reagan rang the relevant general in Israel and then was told within hours that all the necessary measures would be taken. I just look back and think how far things have descended, because these are a lot worse than 1982 in Lebanon, as brutal, as horrific as that was. I don't know. You just think that was Reagan. That was Ronald Reagan.
Yeah. We are not aiming at any good place, I'm afraid. I wish I'm wrong. This war is not over yet. Mm. And it might, you know, also ending the war is a very vague perception, because what does it mean, ending the war? It can say there is a ceasefire, but as long as the Israeli army stays in Gaza, the war is not over, because there will be resistance all the time and there will be retaliation for the resistance. So where do we aiming it? And then what? Leaving Gaza and then what? Staying in Gaza and then what? What is the end game, for God's sake? We asked it from the first day and we're asking it now after 180 days. What is the end game? What do you want to achieve? I hope it's not genocide for the purpose of genocide.
I mean, is that what you... I mean, based on what Israeli leaders have said from the start, it's just the... I mean, again, this is what I found disturbing about coverage is, for me, what I did from the beginning is just listen to what Israeli leaders said and took it literally, which I always found like the you know, Western media coverage failure to just frame everything. You know, Yoav Gallant saying a siege against human animals. And then saying on the 9th of October, he's lifted all restraints on Israeli soldiers. Then the day after, all restrictions on Israeli soldiers. I know it's a clue, but that has, I mean, I just, what's your fit? Do you not look back at some of those statements and the actions and think, well, this is just genocidal?
By the end of the day, whatever they say, almost all of them, is aimed at their political base. Mm-hmm. Nothing but this. They want to be re-elected in the Central Committee of the Likud, so they want to show how radical and how cruel and how brutal they are toward the Palestinians. It's so much domestic politics that you can't even imagine. There is no strategic thinking. Not take even the last assassination in Damascus. Did anyone thought about the day after? What might be the reaction? Is it worth it at all? Except of showing everybody the Israeli Israeli hero. Here he is again, James Bond. He can assassinate anybody, anywhere. What does it serve exactly? What did all the assassinations serve? So there is no thinking. There's only the thought about tonight's news program. How will I come out from there?
Well, grim stuff, but in brilliantly insightful and eloquent and always full of moral clarity and humanity. Honestly, Gideon, it's such an honor. Do share the video, everyone. Obviously, like, leave your comments. Love to read what you think. But Gideon, it's a big honor. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me again, Owen, and keep up your work.
And that was Israeli journalist Gideon Levy being interviewed by British interviewer Owen Jones. That interview is available on YouTube. Just search for Owen Jones and Gideon Levy. Up next is a snippet from a lecture by Ilan Pape. Ilan Pape is an Israeli historian. He's now based in London. Here he describes the history, the brief history of the Gaza Strip and its relationship to the October 7th massacre that Hamas committed.
That before 1948, there was no Gaza Strip. The strip itself is an Israeli invention. Gaza was a cosmopolitical town on the Via Maris, the road from Alexandria up to Alexandretta in Turkey. And because it was the main road on the sea, many people from different countries and cultures passed through Gaza and left an impact that turned it into one of the most cosmopolitical towns before 1948. It also had a very good system of a coexistence between Muslims, Christians, and Jews. Just recently, a friend of ours found an interesting declaration in 1905 by the three heads of the religions in the city of Gaza, expressing their delight in 1905 and how well are the three communities deal with issues of friction, disagreement, and conflict. Israel created the Gaza Strip because, unlike other places into which it could push the many Palestinians it expelled during the Nakba, during the 1948 catastrophe, unlike other countries such as Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, that were willing to receive the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians that Israel expelled, Egypt closed its border. Egypt refused to accept even one Palestinian. And because of that, the leader of Israel, the great architect of the ethnic cleansing of 1948, David Ben-Gurion, who ashamedly has a boulevard named after him in Paris, is a war criminal. And he decided that Israel is willing to give 2% of historical Palestine in order to turn it into the biggest refugee camp in the world. And that's how the Gaza Strip was created, by the Israelis as a kind of rectangle, a structure, a geometric kind of structure, into which Israel pushed the Palestinians from the central of Palestine and from the south that Egypt was unwilling to accept. The last group of Palestinians who were pushed into the Gaza Strip were those living in 11 villages on whose ruins, on the ruins of these villages, Israel built the settlements that were attacked on the 7th of October by the Hamas. So the Hamas attacked settlements built on the ruins of the last villages of Palestine that were destroyed by the Israeli army and expelled to Gaza. In the Israeli archive, we have a very known document called Order Number 40. Order number 40 is from the 25th of November 1948. And it was sent by the Israeli Central Command to the commander in the area of Gaza. And it has the name of the 11 villages. And the order says, and I quote literally what the order says, occupy the village, expel all the people to Gaza, burn the houses, and demolish the stone houses. Because some of the houses of the Palestinian villages in 1948 were built of mortar and straw. And therefore, it was possible to burn them. But the stone houses had to be blown up by the Israeli army. So one historical context we have here is a generation of grandfathers and grandmothers, fathers and mothers, grandchildren that live either directly or indirectly the Nakba of 1948 in a very vivid way on a daily basis, not only because they are thinking about Jaffa or they are thinking about Beersheba or any other place from which they were expelled, but also by watching the Israeli settlements on the other side of the fence from which most of their parents and grandparents came from.
And that was Israeli historian Ilan Pape. There are many informative videos which feature Ilan Pape that are available at YouTube. This is Francesca Albanese delivering her report to the United Nations on Tuesday, March 26, 2024. Francesca Albanese is the UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine.
Provided military, economic, and political support for the atrocity, compounding the devastation it has wrought for the Palestinians. In this assault, the sixth and most egregious in 16 years, Israel has killed more than 30,000 Palestinians, including 13,000 children, more than the children killed in all conflicts worldwide in four previous years. Journalists, doctors, nurses, artists, academics, engineers, scientists, and their family members, a whole society has been targeted. A further 12,000 Palestinians are reported missing, most presumed dead. Some 71,000 Palestinians are reported missing, some 71,000 are injured, most with life-changing wounds, made worse by the decimation of the healthcare system and overwhelming unsanitary conditions created in Gaza. In the first 2 weeks, Israel prevented all humanitarian aid from entering Gaza, and in the ensuing months, it has imposed extreme restrictions of water, food, electricity, and fuel. Israel has blocked the entry of medical supplies, including anesthetics, incubators, and even baby formula. Convoys have hardly reached northern Gaza. The deliberate policy has induced rapid and sustained severe food insecurity in the entire population, with those trapped in the north forced to eat animal feed and grass. The occupying power has also undermined UNRWA, the main lifeline to Palestinians in Gaza. Growing numbers of Palestinians are dying of starvation as we speak. And the hostages and their families have also not escaped these devastating circumstances. The collective scars of those who survive are certain to last generations. In the initial weeks of the assault, Israeli forces killed around 250 Palestinians daily through an apocalyptic arsenal of weaponry on one of the most densely populated places on Earth. 25,000 tons of explosives, equivalent to two nuclear bombs, unguided munitions, and hundreds of 2,000-pound bunker busters were used to level entire neighborhoods. The ground offensive changed the pattern, but not the scale of destruction. In less than 6 months, Israel has destroyed Gaza, erasing or severely damaging almost all civilian infrastructure and agricultural land, most of homes, healthcare facilities, telecommunication infrastructure, every university, most educational facilities, municipal services, mosques and churches, and innumerable cultural heritage sites, which are integral to the social fabric of Palestine. Israeli soldiers have published footage boasting about their killing of families, mothers, children, the bombing of homes, mosques, and schools. Self-incriminating videos show them sadistically mocking and humiliating their Palestinian victims, not only by violating their physical integrity and right to life, but also their dignity, their most intimate possessions and spaces that the soldiers have entered and looted, and by desecrating cemeteries and places of worship. When the ground offensive started, the number of daily casualties seemed to reduce, but in fact, the level of atrocities increased. Mass disappearance and arbitrary detentions, widespread and systematic torture and inhumane treatment add to the experience of endless death and loss. Desperate people had to search through rubble with their bare hands. Many have been unable to bury and grieve loved ones. These acts of genocide have been motivated by vehement anti-Palestinian discourse, which characterizes the entire Palestinian people in Gaza as enemies to be eradicated or forcibly removed. This rhetoric has been pervasive across all segments of Israeli society. That Israeli high-ranking officials with command authority routinely called on soldiers to annihilate the people of Gaza is compelling evidence of explicit and public incitement to commit genocide. Evidence further indicates that this genocidal incitement has been internalized and acted upon by soldiers on the ground. One of my key findings is that Israel's executive and military leadership and soldiers have intentionally distorted rules of international humanitarian law, distinction, proportionality, and precaution in an attempt to legitimize genocidal violence against the Palestinian people by deliberately stretching the definitions of human shield, evacuation orders, warnings, safe zones, collateral damage, and medical protection, Israel has used their protective function as humanitarian camouflage, with the effect of concealing patterns of conduct from which the only inference can reasonably be drawn is a state policy of genocidal violence against the Palestinians. Blurring the distinction between protected civilians or civilian infrastructure and combatants or legitimate military targets, Israel has effectively characterized the whole civilian population in Gaza as human shields or terrorist accomplices as a matter of legal policy. Those who managed to evacuate to areas that Israel defined as safe humanitarian zones have been met with further attacks, their deaths and injuries justified as collateral damage. By making repeated claims which have been systematically discredited that Hamas used hospitals as operation centers, Israel appears to be operating on the premise that if you tell a lie long enough, people will believe it. Israel has used the camouflage of humanitarian law to characterize the entire Palestinian people and life-sustaining and life-saving infrastructure of Gaza as targetable, killable, destroyable. Israel has attempted to legitimize, for example, the devastations of Gaza's medical infrastructure, which has led to potentially thousands of additional deaths, life-changing injuries and trauma. IHL has thus been distorted to justify a war of annihilation. In light of this, I find that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the threshold indicating the commission of the crime of genocide against Palestinians as a group in Gaza has been met. Specifically, Israel has committed three acts of genocide with the requisite intent, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, and imposing measures intended to prevent birth within the group. The genocide in Gaza is the most extreme stage of a long-standing settler colonial process of erasure of the native Palestinians. For over 76 years, this process has oppressed the Palestinians as a people in every way imaginable, crushing their inalienable right to self-determination demographically, economically, territorially, culturally, and politically. Israel has attempted to displace them, expropriate their land and other resources, and ultimately replace them. The colonial amnesia of the West has condoned Israel's colonial settler project from the violent history of the very birth of the State of Israel to its oppressive occupation since 1967, the crippling closure of Gaza since 1993, and its military assaults on Gaza since 2007. The world now sees the bitter fruit of the impunity afforded to Israel. This was a tragedy foretold. While the International Criminal Court will have to deliberate, the International Criminal Court will have to investigate. It is my responsibility to remind you that the Genocide Convention includes a jus cogens norm and erga omnes obligation to prevent the commission of genocide, a reality the International Court of Justice recognized as plausible exactly 2 months ago. The time for states to act was then, and as they did not, the time is now. In this darkest hour, the international community cannot continue to ignore that it's Israel's project to rid Palestine of Palestinians in defiance of international law and the world's failure to call Israel to account that has led to genocide laid bare in Gaza. Denial of the reality and the continuation of Israel's impunity and exceptionalism is no longer viable, especially in light of yesterday's binding Security Council resolution. I implore member states to abide by their obligations, which start with imposing an arms embargo and sanctions on Israel, and so ensure that the future does not continue to repeat itself. Thank you.
I thank you.
Okay, if you were just joining us, we were just listening to the UN Special Rapporteur, Francesca Albanese, presenting her report to the Human Rights Council, saying that there are reasonable grounds that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza.
This is British politician George Galloway responding on a call-in radio show. He responds to a listener's question.
I was just calling on, I was listening to you a couple of nights ago, and you were talking to these people, and they were saying that the Jews did not have the right to gain Israel from the Palestinians. And I was just saying, throughout history, the Jews have been persecuted, obviously, from the Holocaust, and we were granted Israel as a result of this.
Granted by whom?
From Britain and other countries, granted us that.
Well, what right did Britain have to grant you somebody else's country?
Well, it's due because we lost 6 million people.
No. I'm not arguing about that. I'm going to come on to that. What right did Britain have to grant you somebody else's country?
Well, they were basically gave us because of the.
But they gave you somebody else's country. That's the point I'm making, Alex. Can you deal with it? Britain granted you somebody else's country. I'm asking you, what right did Britain have to grant you somebody else's country? The Jews have suffered. They were subject to regular discrimination at best and murder at most. The one place in the entire world that Jews were neither discriminated against nor subject to pogrom was the Muslim world. That's why, under the protection of the Muslims, the Jews left Europe. Palestine, that was wiped off the map when Britain granted you somebody else's country.
And coming up next here, we have an examination of Christian Zionism.
I've always wondered why some of Israel's biggest supporters are American evangelical Christians, like this woman who I met in Jerusalem.
My greatest joy is to be with the people of Israel.
I wanted to know why people like her think this way, despite the harm it causes their fellow Christian Palestinians. It turns out evangelicals are a major source of political support for Israeli policies, even those that go against international law. The biggest pro-Israel group in the U.S. is actually an organization called Christians United for Israel.
And it's not uncommon to hear evangelical preachers say things like this.
Israel is God's chosen people, always have been God's chosen people, always will be God's chosen people.
This is something Sharon believes too. She's an American evangelical who's lived in Jerusalem for almost 40 years. She says the Bible commands her to support Israel.
We see all over God's word that the Jewish people at a certain point in history would begin to find their way back home. And we know that happened in May 1948 when the state became a real nation. And ever since then, the Jewish people have been coming home. And we've been living in Bible prophecy ever since.
Wait, let's unpack that. What Bible prophecy is Sharon talking about?
There will be a big event that will happen here in Jerusalem, and that will be the Messiah. Will come here.
Sharon's referring to what evangelicals call the end times. The idea is that once Jews return to Israel, Jesus Christ will come back to earth and rapture Christians up to heaven. And in some interpretations, this will actually lead to the death of two-thirds of all Jews. Doesn't quite sound like the holiest alliance, does it? Still, the state of Israel is more than happy to accept evangelical Christian support. Listen to what Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told attendees of this evangelical conference.
Now they're millions and millions of devout Christians who stand with Israel. So I want to thank you on behalf of all the people of Israel.
So what do Palestinian Christians think of all this?
You have my sisters and brothers who are supposed to be my support, actually doing all their best to support the ones who are oppressing us. It makes me angry.
That's Munder Ishaq, a Palestinian pastor who lives in Bethlehem, the city believed to be the birthplace of Jesus. By the way, Bethlehem is now surrounded by this massive Israeli wall and military checkpoints.
Why is their read of the Bible so different?
Evangelicals read the Bible in a very literal and simple way. They see in it an image of God who is a tribal God who favors one nation over everyone else based on a promise that's thousands of years old.
Considering Christianity preaches equality and loving thy neighbor, I wondered, how does someone like Sharon justify her support of Israel?
For the Palestinian Christians who would say to you, we are actively being oppressed by the state of Israel, what do you say to them?
I would say, take a look at the scriptures and love them and be a blessing in any way you can, even if you're being persecuted. What did Jesus say? He said, turn the cheek.
Do you think they should love their oppressor?
I don't believe that Israel is oppressing them.
It's clear to me that God is not pleased with the occupation. God weeps over the situation of Palestinians. God weeps over the people who lose their lands. God weeps over the children who are killed every day. We need our Christian sisters and brothers to realize this and to help us